Union man, union man, he must have full dinner can. AFL-CIO, call on strike, out she go. I think I sing this little song, hope I say it nothing wrong. Hope my song she bring you cheer, just like a couple of shots of beer. Union man, union man.
The late Dr. Louis Andreas, in 1937, was a pioneer in the field of group medicine. His interest, though, extended outside the medical field. And thus he found himself, during the Republic Steel Strike of 1937, on the south side of Chicago, outside the plant, during a moment of crisis and need.
There's a kind of parallel between what was going on in the labor movement now and what's going on in the race situation. People interested themselves in this thing from the church and professional people and social workers and all kinds of people were in on this thing. And some of the workers didn't particularly like this. They just wondered what we were doing there. But they didn't mind me because I'd been invited to go out by a fellow called me. He said, look, we got a very nasty situation here. There are probably going to be some injuries, you know. There's not a hospital within miles around. There's not even a drugstore. Would you come out and kind of get the little first aid station started there in case something happens? So this appealed to me very much in those days. And I went out. There was a tavern called Sam's Place. I took a few supplies from my office. We were over on still on South State Street at that time. And got the little first aid station started. Well, a few days before Memorial Day, this is 37, they decided to picket the Republic Steel mills according to the specifications of the Wagner Labor Act. And they did, and they got clobbered, you know. There were a few split skulls and a few fractures. And a few days before that. Well, everybody got mad. And they decided to try it again on Memorial Day.
Oh, yes.
You want the whole story? Yeah. I was there as a doctor. You know? And a great big mob came together, a very hostile mob. Some of them were looking for trouble. And many people on a family picnic sort of thing, little kids, you know, people dressed up in their Sunday shirts and all that. A very mixed crowd. The police were standing in the line in front of the Republic Steel mill, quite a distance from it.
Chicago police.
Chicago police. Mayor Kelly was out of town. It was a holiday. So they began wandering out. There was one hell of a hot day, you know, the haze there. The air was quivering from the sun. And they went out there, and I could see the line of police. They had their winter uniforms on, and it was over 90.
Yeah.
And all I could see were their stars glittering, you know, the long line. And this bunch stopped short. As it turned out, nobody was armed. But I think that the police got the idea that these people were armed, some of them at least. They were told so by Captain Mooney and Lieutenant Kilroy. Those were the two guys who were managing this thing, and Kelly was out of town. Well, I stood there. I stayed behind. I heard some popping going on, and a blue haze began rising. And I said, my God, tear gas. What do you do for that? I couldn't remember what the doctor's book said about tear gas, and if I had remembered, I had nothing to do for it anyway. So I ran back to Sam's place, and about 3 minutes later, they began bringing in the wounded, shot, you know. There were about 50 that were shot, and 10 of them died, and they were lying on the floor, bleeding, bullet wounds in the belly, bullet wounds in the leg, and all over the place. And with all sorts of other things, fractures, lacerations, I had absolutely no preparation at all. I was practically alone, so I just jumped up in a chair. I said, get all gunshots out of here right away and get into the nearest hospital.
Get all the gunshots.
Get them out, you know. I can't handle them. I made an analysis after this thing subsided. You know, I got all of the records of all the cases. I made a pretty accurate summary of these gunshots. I made charts and so forth. And they were shot, the great majority of them, from behind. From behind. There was no really back. Well, what happened was this. There were a few rocks thrown by these guys at the police. When the shooting started, or maybe even before that, they all turned. I said in my testimony there, the shutters in a Venetian blind, they just turned and ran. As they were running, the police continued to shoot into them. This is what happened. We decided after the way the newspapers handled this thing, that something ought to be done about it. The misrepresentation was so dreadful. There was a picture in the Tribune, for instance, the back page, you know, the illustrations, of a little old guy lying in a prairie on his back, his white shirt on, because it was Sunday or and Labor Day and Memorial Day, and blood streaming down his face. And Lieutenant Kilroy was over him, beating the hell out of him with his club, and the caption was, "Striker beats up police at Republic Steel riot." You know, I said, we can't let this go. It's either you or me or nobody. You know, this is going to be history someday, unless we do something about it. So we decided to have a meeting, a mass meeting at the Civic Opera House. And we just created a little bit pompous kind of a statement to the people, to the citizens of Chicago, you know, a call for action. And we decided to have this meeting at the Civic Opera House. And Paul Douglas was the chairman. And
Robert Morris Lovett.
And Robert Morris Lovett came, and Carl Sandburg came, and A. Phillips Randolph came, and I came.
We had the meeting.
You remember me?
Yeah.
You know, I just called the names of these guys. Somebody else called the name of these fellows, and then I would describe the wounds, and an organ was playing, and almost everybody in the place was crying. It wasn't a dry eye in the house. Do you remember Morris, Robert Morris Lovett?
Oh.
He got up and he said, "Captain Mooney is a killer!" In his aristocratic Irish accent, you know. And Carl Sandburg got mesmerized by A. Phillips Randolph of the Pullman, the Union of Pullman car, Sleeping Car Porters, you know, the Union of Sleeping Car Porters, and he got up and he began chanting.
Right.
He didn't say a damn thing.
Yeah,
he got caught up in the rhythm of his life. That's right. Of course, these were great days, I think, so much better than now, because we had achievable goals, you know.
What's that?
Well, our goals then were immediate and achievable, you know. We wanted to promote the interests of labor. And the reason we wanted to do this, I'm thinking about outsiders like myself and Bob Lovett and all the rest, and we felt that their interests were identified with ours, because after all, the Social Security laws and the eight-hour day and the child labor laws and the unemployment insurance business, all that was very definitely connected with the labor movement. And so we identified ourselves with this, and it seems to me that those goals have been pretty largely achieved.
In those 30s, Dr. Andreas, practicing medicine as he did primarily on behalf of low-income people, found himself, during the Depression, serving the needs of what was then the depressed middle class as well.
People were having a hell of a hard time. In medicine, people were dying because they couldn't get medical care, because they couldn't afford medical care, or because they couldn't take the sacrifice of dignity that would be required to go to the free institutions. The old cliche was, you know, that the poor got good care because they could go to the free dispensaries and clinics and so forth, and the rich got good care because they could afford it, and there was this big middle class that was not getting good care. Well, the fact is that the middle class got into the position pretty much of the poor people, but the poor people would not hesitate to go to the clinics, the free facilities. There was no loss of self-respect for them. They were used to this kind of business. But the middle class couldn't drag itself, you know, to that point. So it was, after all, the spirit of the free hospital, like the county hospital, and the spirit of the free clinic was a bit of the spirit of the almshouse, you know, the atmosphere. I remember I was working in the Northwestern Dispensary at that time, and we noticed that a lady who was coming to us rather frequently, this is on Chicago Avenue, you know, on Chicago campus, would come in a Cadillac and park about three blocks away and walk over. She belonged to a class that I used to call the well-dressed destitute, you know. She had the clothes, she had the Cadillac, she didn't have any money. And she really needed this thing, and she'd come over and get her care for nothing. If she had come up in a Cadillac and the social worker saw her, she would have been excluded automatically. But there was a large class, and I used to use that term, of people in that status who had money, who no longer had money, and who found it very difficult to bring themselves to the point of accepting charity and could not afford medical care. I used to have an office in the Monroe Building, and I look out of the window, and I see guys behind the University Club picking crusts of bread. out of the garbage cans at the same time as they were dumping hundreds of thousands of tons of wheat out of the elevators in the Chicago River. Now, there were discrepancies like this that made us feel that the economy was falling apart. People were starving, actually, on the street. Well, for instance, I was in close contact with a fellow who was a resident. He was there full time in People's Hospital over on Archer Avenue. Every day, he told me, somebody would faint on a streetcar, and they'd bring him in. And they wouldn't even ask any questions. It was fainting from hunger. They'd look over the patient just briefly, but the picture was so familiar, they knew what it was. They'd start intravenous feeding, and when they regained consciousness, they'd give them something to eat. People were flopping on the streets of Chicago from hunger. And there was no unemployment insurance or anything of that sort. And they were just simply, and they couldn't all go and ask for money all the time or for a handout. They weren't all selling apples.
What did you sense about the ordinary guy, the guy on the street? Was his attitude one of change or was it acceptance?
No, I don't think it was acceptance, but I think it was perplexity. He was mad, and I think that unless something like the New Deal had come up, he might have begun to get violent. You probably remember a very ominous march down Michigan Avenue one day, a very silent, straggling march, you know, of the unemployed. And nobody said anything. They're just a dark mass of people flowing down that street. And I think in their minds then was this point, the point will be reached where we're not going to take this.
When was that
but,
march?
Well, I would say this was about 34 or something like that, you know. I remember particularly because of the silence. This was a glum march. There was no waving of banners, no enthusiasm, but an undercurrent of desperation, and I would say maybe of uncrystallized intent to do something about it if all this didn't stop. You know. It was the hopeful voice of FDR. You know, they got this thing out of the swamps, and they didn't really have anything much to offer, but it was enough.
I was feeling kind of hungry, so I thought I'd buy some bread. I went into the corner grocery store. I took out the usual money, but the grocer shook his head, 'cause a dollar ain't a dollar anymore. Oh, a dollar bill, don't buy what it used to, don't buy what it used to, don't buy what it used to. A dollar bill, don't buy what it used to, 'cause a dollar ain't a dollar anymore.
The recollections of the late Dr. Louis Andreas, whose real name was Lawrence Jacks, who served so well during the Republic Steel Strike of 1937. He became the hero, incidentally, of the novel dealing with that very event, that theme, by Meyer Levin, the novel Citizens, that was published in the early 40s.